Nehemiah chapter 2. One thing we as believers ought to keep in mind as we go through life is that God is active in the decisions and the actions even of non-Christian people, even non-Christian institutions. God uses them to accomplish his purposes every day. In Ezra's day, King Cyrus, we're told, was God's chosen instrument in his time. And that was whether or not Cyrus himself recognized that fact. He was still an instrument in God's hand. And when God was done with him, he judged him. And so God uses non-Christians, people, and institutions. Well, in chapter 1, we've seen something of the private life of Nehemiah, the burden that he bears, and we looked at the content of his prayers. He finished that prayer, and at the end of that chapter in verse 11, make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. And then he throws in that little tidbit at the very end, now I was the cupbearer to the king, almost as though it were incidental. Now we learn of his public affairs. That was his private, now his public. And we're given a glimpse into his daily life and work in a pagan throne room. Chapter 1 was his prayers to God. Chapter 2 begins with his words to the king. You know, our private times, we could easily say, our private times with God prepare us for our interactions with the lost world. Well, we have the circumstances surrounding the answer to Nehemiah's prayer. So let's read, let's begin reading in chapter 2. We'll piece our way through this morning in chapter 2 and verse 1 at the very beginning. He says, and it came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. The circumstances surrounding the answer to Nehemiah's prayer, which we had in chapter 1. Well, September was the beginning of the reign of their kings in this Persian calendar. And we can become a little bit confused because we try and transpose the English calendar on the Persian one and it doesn't work very well. But September was the beginning of the reign of their kings, and Nehemiah had received the bad report that he got about the condition of Jerusalem in about the November time frame on an English calendar. And chapter 2 opens with the calendar date, the date of Nisan, which is roughly March for us. So you see, he got the bad report in November, and here we are in March, basically. That might help us to kind of assimilate that a little bit, instead of Nisan and Chislev and all of that, 20th year of the king. And just remember it this way. November and March. And it came about. I like those words. You know, it almost sounds coincidental, doesn't it? By coincidence. And it came about. But the working of the Lord often appears like a coincidence. But he's got his hand in it. He's turned something, he's done something, and we might say, well, you know, by coincidence, this happened or that happened. But we ought to suspect the working of the Lord in things that appear coincidental. And it came about, says Nehemiah. Even though he asked for success today, and it came about 4 months later. As a matter of fact, well over 100 days had passed since Nehemiah began to pray, and I would assume he would be tempted to be discouraged. I would. You know, I'm praying today, success, today's success, and 100 days have passed and nothing yet. A man that I read named Raymond Brown, he said, God knows the best timing for everything. Believers constantly need to accept that behind life's frustrations lie a divine purpose. Something can be learned even from our most difficult experiences. Waiting time is not wasted time, says Brown. Well, think of this. Those days that Nehemiah was waiting, they allowed him to better consider what lied ahead, what he needed to do. He was able to view with a different perspective all the problems that were going to be awaiting him in Jerusalem. If he was to go, he was more prepared and better able to relate his plan with a higher degree of composure to the king and a better effectiveness. So overall, the whole effort was given a higher degree of success because he had 4 months right there. What if he would have come before the king instantly on the very day that he prayed that? He might have been caught flat-footed and not had much of a plan or much of an answer. But as a result of the delay, we read these words, and it came about. So let's continue on looking at Nehemiah here before the king. Here's a day, and it seems like it's life as usual. Seems like a day like every other day. He's in the court of the king. He's the cupbearer. Wine was present. And it was his job to taste it, make sure it wasn't poisoned at all before passing it off to the king. He says, wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. So his prayer, the Lord grant me success today. He really did need God's help in the presence of the king. Some 16 years earlier, Zerubbabel began to rebuild the temple back in Jerusalem under a different king, different administration. And they met opposition. And a letter was sent back to Persia and opposing the Jews rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. And in that letter, the Jews were called rebellious and evil. The city was a rebellious and an evil city. And so the king at the time sent a decree and stopped the work of the temple. The foundation had been laid, but that was it. Have you ever heard of anything called the law of the Medes and the Persians? Well, if you've recently read through Daniel or maybe Esther, you found this phrase, the law of the Medes and the Persians. In Daniel 6, now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, and which may not be revoked. Three times it was said in Daniel, the law of the Medes and the Persians can't be revoked. It's like it was in their constitution or something, that once there was this law on the books, you couldn't revoke it. In fact, you find it in Esther as well. The statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. You know, that was the whole reason Daniel ended up in the lion's den. He found favor in King Darius's eyes, but King Darius got tricked into making that decree that ended up sentencing Daniel to the lion's den. And you'd think, hey, you're king, just change it. But the law of the Medes and the Persians cannot be revoked. So here you have this temple that was under construction back under Zerubbabel in Jerusalem, and it was opposed, and the king wrote an edict and stopped it, this rebellious and evil city. And not only was the temple in part of the construction, but the walls as well are stated there in that letter. So we've got the law of the Medes and the Persians, and here sits our man Nehemiah before the king, and he has it on his heart, a burden, to go back to Jerusalem and do what? Rebuild it when there's a decree against that. So he needs help, you see. Well, here he is. He thought it was a day like every other day, but it was a day, as it turns out, like no other day. I think of that exhortation in James, you do not know what a day might bring forth. It's good to remember that, I think, as believers. We don't know what a day will bring forth. Well, he says at the end of verse 1, now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, why is your face sad, though you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. And then I was very much afraid. Well, the king noticed his sadness. Why are you sad? And, you know, in the court of the king, everyone was supposed to be pleasant and cheerful. It was forbidden to be sad or downcast or dejected or anything like that in the presence of the king. He was viewed as this wonderful deity, and to be downcast when you were so privileged as to be in this guy's presence, that was an insult to him. Well, Nehemiah says, I was very much afraid. And as we go through this book, we'll see there wasn't a whole lot that scared Nehemiah. But he was afraid there. He had a moment of panic, even stout-hearted Nehemiah. You know, tyrants and monarchs, they weren't known for their kind-hearted tolerance. And here he is nearby, obviously sad and downcast. And it wasn't expected that the king would be impressed by sullen Nehemiah standing there. It was considered a punishable offense to be sad in the presence of the king, and the king had absolute power, life and death power, over everyone. So naturally, Nehemiah says, he was very afraid. In Esther chapter 4 and verse 2, you might recall that Mordecai went as far as the king's gate, no further. Why? For no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. You couldn't be there dressed like that, garbed up like you're in mourning, grief. The king wants happy people around him, not sad people that are going to bum him out and drag him down. Well, not only that, but Nehemiah was afraid because it could ruin any of his chances with favor in the eyes of the king toward the work that he had planned in Jerusalem. But I'm thankful that the King of Kings doesn't forbid me coming into his presence with a sad face and a heavy heart. He accepts us. He was a man of sorrows himself, acquainted with grief. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ear is open to their cry. Not just their praise, but their cry. So if that's the state of your heart, don't let your own conscience or the devil tell you, you better stay out of the presence of the king. He doesn't want to hear you being such a crybaby. When Bob was sick and dying and Conrad Merle came to visit, he sat on my couch. We sat there and talked in my house. And I told him, you know, I can't help it. I feel like a crybaby. And he sat there for a while. I've related this to you before, maybe. But he said, well, you know, David was. And so I felt a lot better after that. You can come into the presence of the Lord with a heavy heart, shedding tears, and you're not going to be like a Persian king. You're not going to find a punishment sent your way as a result of that. In fact, the Holy Spirit is called the Comforter. But nonetheless, what reasons we have to be joyful in the presence of our King, we heard already this morning. In your presence is fullness of joy, and in your right hand there are pleasures forever. Well, Nehemiah, he had a trembling faith. That tells me that fear and faith can coexist at the same time in the same heart. Fear and faith. Well, Nehemiah's reply. The king says, basically, what's wrong, Nehemiah? And Nehemiah says, oh, nothing. We do that all the time, don't we? What's bothering you? Oh, it's nothing. We dismiss it. Well, he didn't do that. He didn't apologize. He didn't put on a happy face. He knew now was the time for him to come out with it. His long-awaited opportunity was here. God gave him help before the king and to answer in answer to his prayer. That happened right then, on a day that seemed like any other day. Common duties, daily duties, all of a sudden, after 4 months' time, the door is open. Now's the time. You know, we're rarely given everything we need in advance. We would like a rehearsed script. We'd like storehouses of courage and piles of strength and confidence beforehand, before we have to face whatever is difficult, wouldn't we? I would. But grace is most often given right at the time of need. It's been my experience anyway. Resourcefulness in a way that was never anticipated, enabling a rise up to the challenge. That's the experience of believers when they come into a difficult time. God's sufficiency realized at the moment of need. Someone said, we're not given dying grace to live by. You're given dying grace to die by and with. A father with a child gives to his child a ticket to ride the train right when they're about ready to board it. Not weeks ahead of time or months ahead of time. So we receive grace right at the moment, right at the instant that we need it. Well, verse 3, so I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad? When the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire. He dared to give an honest answer. I've got a good reason to be sad, he said. And he talked about the place of his father's tomb and its desolation. The king and his nobles couldn't object to something like that because they felt the same way about their burial grounds. The burial grounds of their ancestors, they held to be sacred places as well. So then the king said to me in verse 4, what would you request? Sometimes a door can be tightly shut, sometimes it can be bolted and barred, and it seems like you're never going to get in, and then in an instant it swings free on its hinges. here after 4 months' time and this prayer and concern, all of a sudden he hears those words. What would you request? The king invites him to make a request, and he recognized the open door, so now's the time. With four words, the prayers of 4 months reached an answer, the time of their fulfillment. In the next few moments, everything would be changed and decided. So although he had prayed for months, he dared not face this next crucial bit of conversation without recognizing God in it, because prayer was natural for Nehemiah. So the question was in verse 4, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven on the spot. Nehemiah didn't ask time to pray and reflect and get back to the king on the matter. He didn't do that. He didn't seek a particular place to get away to pray. At any moment, at any time, we have an opening before the King of Heaven. Someone called this making good use of chance moments. You know, there are travel times, there are times waiting in line, there are times waiting in the lobby or waiting in the examining room. There are times, chance times, where prayer can be sent up to heaven. Here may be the place for an arrow prayer. Theologically, the scholars call this Nehemiah's arrow prayer, because you can kind of picture it, can't you? The king says, what would you request? And instantly he sends up an arrow to God. An archbishop said, one moment will suffice to place yourself in God's presence. If you wait for seasons convenient, you run the risk of waiting forever. The less time one has, the more carefully it should be spent. Well, another thing that we can conclude from this is prayer is compatible with secular work. Here, Nehemiah was just on the job doing his duty. But we can pray in the same way. We can still approach God the same way, even if we're in the middle of our jobs. Difficult situations, difficult people, both may be moved by spontaneous prayer, which is what this was. It was spontaneous prayer on the spot. Well, he needed to know the right thing at the right time and how to say it in the right way. And I think God answered that prayer immediately. There was a lot hanging in the balance there. And not only did God answer that prayer by filling Nehemiah's mouth with the right requests, but at the same moment, God filled the mind of the king with supportive thoughts and a generous spirit, and instantly that prayer was answered. It's an occasion where a prayer is sent and a prayer is answered momentarily. Well, I'm thankful that the King of Kings offers an invitation to us like this king did to Nehemiah. What would you request? Ask what you will, Jesus said, and it'll be given to you. He said, ask for a fish, you won't get a snake. Ask for an egg, you won't get a scorpion. Ask what you wish. Our king. Well, the response of this king here, I said to the king in verse 5, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will your journey be, and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. The king wanted to know, reasonably, how long and when. And it pleased the king to send him. Now, our man Nehemiah here, we can be encouraged by him and his example. He had a deliberate plan. He thought this through already. He thought it out carefully. He knew how long he would need to be gone and what the materials would be that he would need and what amount of work needed to be done. He had it planned out. Now, faith is no substitute for planning. They go together. Faith and planning can go together. He planned out an effective strategy. We aren't more spiritual because we wing it and we just go through life without a plan. Some people tend to think that maybe there's an element of piety there and just being able to trust God and don't make plans. Well, we don't find that with Nehemiah here. He had it well thought out. He knew what to ask when the occasion came. Some people call being led by the Spirit all that really is a lack of planning and preparation. And it's reasonable to commit. That's another lesson right here. Nehemiah gave him a definite time and when he would return. He committed. That's reasonable. We ought not to be just non-committal and wishy-washy. Some people may or may not be there, even though they said they may or they might not. It's reasonable to commit. He gave him a definite time. In construction terms, we call that a date of completion. You got a deadline. Better get this done by that time. And then verse 7, and I said to the king. Verse 8 starts, and. Once he got an open door, he didn't quit right there. He kind of pushed it. He asked for even more. So Nehemiah anticipated trouble on the journey. He requested documents, permits, travel pass, if you want to call it that, that gave the king's authority on his right to be there. And he asked for supplies to be requisitioned, building materials, timber from the king's forest for the fortress surrounding the temple and the wall of the city and for the governor's house. And basically, he asked the king to finance all of it. This is what I want to do. Send me back to Jerusalem, the burial place of my father, so that I can rebuild it, and I want you to finance it for me. I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates and for the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And Nehemiah's testimony at the end of verse 8, the king granted them to me. How quickly things can change. All of a sudden, the king granted them to me. Nehemiah received permission to go, letters of passage, provisions for the journey, and the work, and protection. So in unexpected ways, unlikely ways, things can change very quickly. And that which is on the top can be on the bottom, and that which is on the bottom can rotate up to the top when the hand of God is involved in it. He says, because the good hand of God was on me. Now that's an amazing thing to me. Sounds a lot like Ezra in his day in chapter 7 and verse 6, and the king granted him all he requested, because the hand of the Lord, his God, was on him. God does all of that, changes things. And then in verse 9, we discover he even had officers of the army and horsemen that the king sent. Now, apparently, Nehemiah didn't ask for that. At least it's not recorded, and I asked for a military escort. But the king said, I'll give you a military escort as well, because the good hand of God was on him. Sounds a lot like Ephesians 3:20. Now unto him who's able to do far more abundantly than we can ask or think. Sounds like that. Well, this military escort, we've got a difference here between Ezra and Nehemiah, that both of these men of God, in Ezra's case, he was ashamed to ask for a military escort because he wanted to trust in God alone to protect them as they traveled from Assyria back to Jerusalem. That was Ezra. But now we've got Nehemiah, and he's not ashamed to receive an escort. And what does he do? He credits God for supplying it. So you see both of those cases. They're opposite in some ways, but they have that in common. God did it. He supplied the escort in one case, and he honored Ezra in the other. The good hand of God. Well, here's an interesting thought from that man Brown again. He said, the conversation of one traveling brother to Susa from Judea had initiated a chain of events that resulted in the complete refortification of Jerusalem. Most great enterprises can be traced to insignificant beginnings. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters beyond the river, the Euphrates River. My resources tell me that's approximately 800 miles. Can you imagine traveling by caravan with an army and all of the supplies from the king's forest and timbers and all of that for 800 miles across wilderness to get back to Jerusalem? That would be a long time. You'd begin to see the value of an escort there. It becomes apparent because when they arrive, they get opposition from a couple of individuals. It says in verse 10, when Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite official, heard about it, it was very displeasing to them. They were very much disturbed. That's sinister and ongoing, sustained opposition. Remember these two guys, Sanballat and Tobiah, because we haven't seen the end of them. They become very instrumental in our story. Incidentally, archaeology verifies this man, Sanballat. They found some things in what's called the Elephantine Papyri that speak of Sanballat. Also Tobiah the Ammonite. Well, Sanballat is introduced here. He's the governor of Samaria, you remember, from the north. And he views Nehemiah's arrival as a threat. And Tobiah apparently is an ex-slave who's now the governor of Ammon, who's to the east. So the opposition has come from the north and from the east. And a little bit later, as we go on, we'll see it also comes from the south. And they found it displeasing that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Nehemiah and his national patriotism sought the welfare of the sons of Israel. So we have one who's come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel, and then we have two that are intent on opposing it. 2-1. And we haven't heard the last of them. Well, the good hand of God that was with Nehemiah in the court of Susa, thankfully was also with him in the rubble of the wall and Jerusalem in its ruins. We'll stop there this morning.